Africans at home. Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
That's right. We are trying to do it right, but the adversaries and enemies of our people just keep getting in the way. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are here connecting the dots as we usually do. There are struggles on many battlefields, and there are soldiers on all those battlefields. And sometimes those battlefields are about education, sometimes they're about healthcare, sometimes they're about state repression. But what we want to do is to connect them so that we understand that these are not isolated struggles, these are not isolated people fighting. Sometimes they actually know each other, particularly when I bring them on the show. And so we know that we are up against a formidable enemy, but we also know that we have the ability to organize and win. We've done it before. So this is an unusual time that we're in, so we need to recognize that. It's not the same. We got the MAGA monsters still in control. We have genocide going on in Gaza. It may be off the mainstream media, but it's still going on. The U.S. government has left Ukraine people, you know, out there hanging in the wind. So there's a lot going on. And I do want to remind people that today was the day that our government bombed a black neighborhood in Philly. And so the MOVE bombing happened in 1985 on this date. We've had Mike Africa on the show. Since then, his parents have been released, and we're going to get them on soon. We didn't want to mess with May because that's a busy time for them in terms of the remembrance. But we need to keep in mind that that was not the first time a black neighborhood had been bombed. Before then was Tulsa. And so sometimes we forget, or we never knew, because I remember when I first wrote about it in the St. Louis American, there were people who were just appalled that they had never heard of either one of those bombings. And so it's not up to our enemies to tell us about the damage that they've done to us and our people. And so we have to stay on top of it. That's why we say every day is Black History Day, because we always need to be finding out what more do we need to know and what don't we know and why. So, you know, today we want to really get into the remembrance of what has happened to the Black community here in St. Louis. And it wasn't necessarily man-made, but still natural disasters take on a different look and feel depending on where they are. And so we're going to get into that. And I have to say that, you know, the folks who we invited, I'm going to introduce you. The folks from 314 Oasis weren't able to be with us because there's a sickness in the family, but we're going to always make reference to them because we all know that this work was connected. So we have today, we have Rebecca Bennett, who is the founder of Emerging Wisdom and also one of the co-founders of the Black Healing Circle. And they have done a lot of work around not just the relief part of it, the recovery process, the physical, but also what it means for the Black psyche to go through catastrophes like this and the trauma that that comes from that. And we also have Mike McLemore. And Michael was not a doctor when I first met him. He is now. So when do you like to use doctorate? When you try to make people respect you?
Look, honestly, it's one of those things that I think other people, once they learn about me, they kind of force it. Like, no, you're going to use that doctor part in everything. We want to make sure we put that out there first.
Yeah. It is helpful sometimes to do that, because sometimes people don't want to take you seriously till you start talking about the alphabets behind your name, and then they give you a tad bit more respect. But yeah, so welcome to the show, both of you all.
Thank you, Mama Jamala. Now, it's the Black Healers Collective. You got me up in a circle. You said black people
Oh,
first. That's all
okay.
right.
Okay.
That's all right.
And
That's my
I
favorite
know it's
state,
a
right?
collective. Yeah, it definitely is a collective, right?
Yes,
Yeah. So,
ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
yeah,
Good to
thanks
see you,
for that
Michael.
correction. Yeah. So I do want to remind people how this whole thing, came about because, on what the May 16th of last year, a EF3 like ripped through St. Louis. 165 miles an hour, that's a lot of devastation. It caused five fatalities and a heap of damage. Some estimates are as high as $1 billion estimate. But there were dozens of people injured, but hundreds dislocated and made homeless as a result of this. And I think one of the things that often we don't pay attention to is history. And so I'm just going to read an excerpt from a press release that the Organization for Black Struggle put out on May 17th, which literally was the next day because we had been very involved in Katrina. And we saw what's happened in black neighborhoods where there's natural disasters. And it was almost like deja vu, like if we don't do something different here, the same thing is going to happen. And so what we talked about was how disaster relief shows up for predominantly working class areas, and the response always has a race and class lens to it, which is almost inescapable to ignore. So this is the part. This year is the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. The lower Ninth Ward has never been completely rebuilt, and many New Orleans are still displaced. If St. Louis leaders and residents don't fight now for the attention we deserve, North St. Louis will look like other abandoned cities plagued by natural disasters and urban uprisings. And so, that's a year later, look what we have. And I think OBS knew what it was going to look like because most people, just because of who we are, were going to help. That help was individual. It wasn't systemic. It wasn't massive. It was like somebody bringing some food over and helping. It was people like the Urban League, like had tons of stuff for food. But the people's lives have been like destroyed and wrecked because you got to have a home. You got to have that stable place where you can go back and say, "Here's where I belong. Here's my stuff. Here's my family stuff." And that has really not happened. And I know both of you have done different kinds of works in different areas, sometimes those connected. So talk, if you would, about what your role, what your response, what you saw as your responsibility in response to the tornado. And then later on, we're going to give an update on where we think things are now. So Rebecca, why don't you go first?
Yeah, thank you so much, Mama Jamala. I do want to say a little bit more about what the impacts were, if you just give me a
No, go
moment,
ahead. Yes.
because I think it matters, right? That tornado, right, which landed and lasted, for a series of minutes, right, did so much
27.
devastation, right? 27 minutes, right, impacted 28 neighborhoods directly. And of those 28 neighborhoods, 22 are predominantly black. Right, so just to have a sense of everybody who got hit got hurt, and yet disproportionately just by where the tornado landed, right? 22 of those neighborhoods were predominantly black, and that's important. And the damage is about $1.6 billion worth of losses, right? Worth of losses, and of course the losses are much greater than that. That is to say, those are sort of codified losses. There are lots of different ways that our lives, the devastation takes a toll, particularly the longer it takes to actually move that recovery process forward, right? So the damages increases, like if you have a crack in your foundation and it goes without attention. So when you were talking about, look, these sort of the lethargic, lackluster response, right, in working class and in black communities means that the pain that comes from the immediate point of impact amplifies exponentially over time, right? And so it becomes a much bigger loss because the damage that happens ends up getting more comprehensive. We had seven schools close as a consequence, right, of this tornado, right? We had nearly 50,000 people who were living in those impacted areas, neighborhoods, and communities that got affected, and we had 5,000 structures damaged. That is significant, That is significant. That's not a little bit, right? 5,000 is a significant portion of what our built environment looks like, and specifically our built environment when we are thinking about our North St. Louis community, right? It is substantial in terms of the devastation on the landscape, and more importantly, on the people, and 1 million metric tons worth of debris and 10,000 trees uprooted. When we start talking about walkability and all of those things, quality of life and quality of air and all those things, like our natural environment plays a role in that, not just the built environment. And so I just wanted to spend a moment to say those the scars, right? The scars and the devastation were comprehensive. And we haven't seen that kind of devastation in this community, right? In a very long time. I think the closest we can get to sort of natural disaster in that way is floods here, right? Because we are in a floodplain. And the other thing I want to say, and I know you asked about like, well, what are we doing about it? But the other thing I want to
No, no,
say.
no. I wanted you to do this, and I hope Michael will add what you don't cover, because the last time you and I talked, you gave me that comprehensive kind of thing, and I'm like, whoa, people don't even understand the gravity of the situation.
How big, how massive. I think the other thing I want to say, though, is in the bigger picture, we are seeing increasing frequencies of tornadoes in this area. And not just in this area, Tornado Alley is moving east. So when it was largely west in rural areas, less densely populated areas, the impacts and implications were different. But these last 40, 50 years, because of climate crises, words that folks don't like to use in certain administrations, right? But because of climate crises and devastation from greed and man-made behavior, what is happening is that it's moving steadily east in more densely populated, urban, more built environments. So we can expect with greater frequency that we are going to see calamity, environmental devastation and calamity, and we're going to experience it largely as when we start talking climate justice, right? As communities of color, we're going to experience it disproportionately with greater frequency. So treating this and our response to this as sort of a single isolated response is ridiculous when we understand the patterns, not only in political behavior, but in actually how this climate devastation unfolds over time, right? And looking at the way we respond, local government, state government, federal government, to these is telling for what we can expect. Just as you said, hey, we could look back and we could tell you what was going to happen. So I think when people are like, we want to get back to a state of normalcy, and I the need is to actually do more than that, because we are because we need to be braced for more of these realities, and we actually need to develop the competency and the resource base to be able to address these kinds of things and actually build for it, right? That is to say, resource our communities to be able to recover through these kinds of devastations. And right now we haven't gotten the repair part right to even get to what I'm saying next. So, Michael, I want to give it to you because I could keep going, but those are some of the things that are just top of heart and mind for me right now.
Absolutely. And I mean, I literally had just gotten off of a tornado committee call just before this about, where we are now, kind of in the recovery process. But just going back to the day of, so I was an impacted resident, and we're still dealing with the rebuild situation in my home. But it could have been a lot worse for us, because had I not gotten, a text message that said, hey, we were getting weather alerts on our phones, you should probably actually take shelter, I would have never known. Like, I was in a position in my house that, later we lost the roof, that who knows what could have happened in that situation, right? But, I did go outside just to kind of get a look at, the situation, because I've done conservation work before. So, we were trained to kind of read the clouds and, kind of follow weather patterns. So just going out there, I was able to actually pull my uncle, excuse me, and my dog in the house literally seconds before, it touched down over my neighborhood. And by the time we got into the interior hallway, it was already on top of us. So through that, I lost my roof, my porch collapsed. It really just devastated the entirety of my block. And slowly but surely, people were emerging from the homes, and kind of, you're shocked at first, right? Because these are the sights you see in movies. Like, you never expect, these urban tornadoes like this, right? Because
To be on your block.
to be on my block of all places, and it's like, you're shocked, and you're devastated that this thing happened to you. Because growing up, it was always tornadoes don't happen in cities, they have to be able to move around. That's why they're always in the cornfields and all these just, different myths that we had,
In
right?
Kansas.
Right, in Kansas and Oklahoma and all these things. But slowly but surely, everybody kind of emerged from their homes. Luckily, nobody on my area, my block, was, seriously injured. So, we started to kind of take note of, who didn't come out of what house. So, we began the search and rescue efforts in a lot of ways. Once, we were able to at least knock on people's doors to let them know that the situation, the tornado was gone, they could come out. The guttural screams and the reactions that people had, and just utter shock that people, I'm sure, will live with forever at this point, that they're dealing with, was, in and of itself devastating. But, it really took a lot of just regular neighbors to, okay, we have these trees down across the street. Let's move these out of the way, because if somebody is hurt either on this street or the next, at least emergency vehicles can get through. Just up the street from us, there was a school bus letting off at the time. So there was a live wire laying across the school bus. And what a lot of us did was we propped up this live wire. Again, if anybody's listening, these are things not to do, but desperate times call for, these kind of actions, right? So we propped up, this live wire with this, just flat board, just so the bus could clear from underneath it. It couldn't go anywhere else, but at least we got those kids from under that situation. But just seeing all the homes devastated, all the roofs gone, pipes burst, you could smell the gas. There's sights and sounds that I know I'll never forget for sure. But you really just saw communities stepping up in ways that, nobody was trained to do. We had regular young guys, and I can remember this kid in the tank top and dreadlocks trying his best to, move traffic on Natural Bridge and Newstead, which is, it's a pretty big intersection. It's a
That's
bus stop
dangerous.
and everything, right? And he's just trying his best to, kind of keep the flow moving, because it was at a standstill and emergency vehicles couldn't get through. But in the days following, we tried our best to clean up what we could with our home and kind of assist other people, so it, at least having their situation be livable, because for a lot of us, nobody left. We stayed. We've been there since May 16th, and we lived through the entire rebuild. So between us and I think a couple of our neighbors, we tried to make sure that we can make their situation as best as we could. Just given some of the resources that I, had from a previous life in city administration. But I think I made a Facebook post, and Kayla Reed here at Action St. Louis provided us with a dumpster within that first week. So that kind of helped with the debris cleanup. And then, kind of throughout that process, I was, whenever I could charge my phone, I would get those just daily updates from all the action happening up at the O'Fallon Park YMCA through the People's Response. So it's like, okay, I know that, our folks are, kind of doing what they can to take care of people. But you also didn't get those city updates as far as like what was happening. Like, you'd get a random press conference that, again, all of us are in the dark in the, for the first 2 weeks. We were in the dark for 11 days. So we would, hear whispers about like what the mayor or, her staff had said, but we didn't have a clear, idea of, one, when we would have electricity back, or, what the cleanup process would ultimately look like. But I was able to follow, the people's response to kind of see the work that they were doing. So by the time I was able, maybe a week or so into recovery, I got to a point where, I did all I could for my family. We needed contractors to do a lot of the work after that point. So I volunteered at the O'Fallon Park YMCA, and I spent the next however many weeks up there, and I just never left. So now, I'm Action St. Louis staff as, our electoral justice organizer. So I can utilize, a lot of these, life experiences I've had up to this point. But we're still very active in this tornado fight. And, as priorities are shifting now towards what long-term recovery looks like, we're really trying to press that issue as far as like what, the community has told us that they need or the things that they really want to see come out of the rebuild to make it better than what it was, prior to the storm.
And I know we had not had a comparable tornado since the 50s, but I had a hard time drumming up pity for the Spencer administration in terms of that response, because that has not been the only response to a tornado in Missouri or the rest of the country. And so my thing is, tapping mayors who've had, what did they do, real quick? Why are we stumbling and fumbling around? And so I did write a column about how we dealt with the flood of 93, because 92, 93, because I was with the Bosley administration, and he got really high marks for the way that he responded. But you got to be quick. You got to garner as many folks as you can in your own administration. And I had even suggested to Mayor Spencer that she pull out volunteers from the various departments, maybe who weren't as busy as they could should have been, or whatever, to say, here's how you deploy it. There's people already there. Go to these neighborhoods, ask for Mike McLemore or Rebecca. They're there on the ground. We saw none of that. And as you said, Mike, for 11 days, you didn't really see or hear anything. So I'm just wondering, what, first of all, what have we learned from the fact that, to your point, Rebecca, we're going to see these more often? Climate change is happening. And not only are they going to be more often, it's been predicted they'll be more intense.
More severe.
So, yeah, more severe. And so looking ahead, and even though we're still grappling with the situation currently, what have we learned, or could we learn from this? And then I have a question about FEMA that I want you all to respond to. So what have we learned? And Michael, you said you just got out off a call, and these folks gave you what kind of rosy picture?
So that call was really, there wasn't a lot of information there because, we asked a lot of questions around what the finance looks like, right? How do we get to the $110 million allocation for Rams funds when the recovery office said that, the bill to at least do the bare bones repairs for everybody that applied through their program was closer to 140. So how does the same office undercut itself in this process and expect, to actually, retain residents in the impacted area, or even just like assessing like federal HUD's funds? We had, Carnegie Endowment here, and they found out that the average time to receive those funds when they're actually fought for from the local and federal levels is roughly 4 months. So how did we end up with a timeline that says September 2027? These kind of things don't make sense. And they didn't have those answers, and we'd have a follow-up later, to kind of speak about it. But I think the residents and people from Oryx that did attend the meeting, really left frustrated, because we didn't get we one we didn't get any
Again.
answers, right? And then there's at least talks of creating additional committees to do the same things that the initial committee was set out to do. So it's like, what are we? We're wasting each other's time right now, whereas we could really be on the ground or really making real allocations to spend money to really, change folks' lives or bring them back home. Because ultimately, I think that that's one of the biggest goals, right? To bring folks home and to retain the identity of these impacted neighborhoods, so that you don't have all these predator developers and realtors come in, buy up all this property, and completely flip the image. We still get daily calls right now, like, what do you want to do with the home? It's like, we're rebuilding, we're almost there, right?
Back off, back
We're
off.
getting close. But I do know that a lot of people were desperate in the immediate aftermath of the storm, and they took whatever they could. So then they packed a laundry basket, and we haven't seen them since. So, dealing with stuff like that, I think, and I think I forgot the original question,
That's okay.
but
That's
just speaking in terms of, just what I've seen and some of the calls and everything that I've been on most recently, the frustration is growing, the distrust is growing. And, as all these kind of like news investigations to public records requests are starting to coming out, we're starting to see the contradictions of what you're hearing in court versus, what the reality looks like from, inside the recovery office.
I want to talk about some. I appreciate
And yeah, go ahead.
Michael got us
Oh, yeah.
started, and you got us started. You were like, let's talk about the money, right? So I want to go there a bit, right? When we think about sort of funding for recovery, there are three main pots, right? Just make it real simple. Pot one, federal pot, right? And you heard Michael talk about sort of HUD funding, and largely that's community development block grants, right? And he started talking about, well, what's the timeline to get those? Like, if we look at like how long it took Joplin to get their block grants, their community development block grants, it took 11 months. 11 months, right, for Joplin, following the tornado, right? That's a comparable sort of event in our state. When we think about how long it took St. Louis to get its community development block grant after the 22 flood, 2022, it was 12 months. Right now we are 1 year after the tornado happened, but I want to put there that yes, the sort of ideal cycle might be 4 months, but even with these other experiences in our own state, right? What we saw was a shorter timeline, right? And so one of the things that Michael talked about early was is residents doing for residents, right? Neighbors doing for neighbors, taking care of holding up live wires and checking, going door to door. If you didn't come out your house, hey, let's go check on Miss So and so, or let's go check on Mr. So and so, or let's help clean up, or let's get this right. And I think part of what we need is, and part of what our city government needs to do is to actually give residents sort of advocacy points, like help us help you, actually, right? Because I think a good piece of this is actually going to be our own advocacy for federal dollars and federal support, right? That if you talk about $1.6 billion in losses, and those are hard losses, not much less sort of softer losses, right? We're not going to get that through city funds. Real talk. Like that's not primarily where
Right,
that's going to happen.
right.
It's going to have to come from where most disaster dollars come from in our country, and that's from the feds, right? And so part of a pivot for us has to be that the same way that our communities were taking care of each other. Our advocacy game for our region, and we are advocating. We're advocating at state levels, we're advocating at the local level, but our advocacy game for this federal support is going to need to intensify because there's not another easier sort of path to get the level of resourcing that we need from another source. You heard Michael talk about, the second pot. So if there's the Fed pot, there's the city pot, and then there's a what I would call sort of private pot, like philanthropy, banks, that sort of thing. Philanthropy is can give you grants, banks can give you loans, or they can give you products that are non-predatory, right? But that really help you do more. And so they marshal private capital to help support rebuilding. Rams, you said, look, we heard from you that it's going to take about 140 million. You're talking 110 million, but let's just say this, even that 110 million is not yet secured, right? It's not yet secured, and we need it. We do need it, and we know that there are champions within city government for it, but honestly, it's not here yet, right? And when we look at the number of applications, right, for home repair, 2,760 applications for stabilization and repair, 2,760. With the money that we currently have allocated from the city, because that's mainly city dollars. Let's be clear about where money's going. You get a lot of big money from the feds, but that big money is not going to stabilization and repair in that way. That's not where those dollars are going. Those dollars are going to demolition, right? Because they're investing in like sort of public safety and hazard mitigation. That's where federal dollars are going. So let's just talk about this. So where the biggest money is not going to repair and recovery. That's not the city's fault, but it is the way FEMA works. Like real talk is how it works. But what the city has to contribute without the Rams dollars, Michael, right now, out of those 2,760 homes that folks that have applied for repair, we got enough to support maybe 200 today.
Yeah.
Less than 10%, right? Today. So if we don't get those Rams dollars secured, there's no way, real talk, there's just no way that we are going to be able to help people rebuild, repair, and stay in place. Because our instinct, as Michael talked about, right? Our instinct is to stay in place. It's to stay rooted, right? This is where I live. This is where the greatest investment of my life is. This is where my people are. This is where my kids, my neighbors, my everything is here. Mm-hmm. That's our instinct, is to stay. But it becomes impossible to help people stay at the level of resourcing that currently exists. So A, we absolutely need Rams dollars. We need Rams funding, critical funding to go towards that home repair and stabilization. And largely we're talking about, when we talk about repair, we're talking about the rapid repair program. So this is not like, we're gonna fix everything in your house, as Michael knows. Right. This is like, we're gonna keep you from being out on the street, right? We wanna make sure that your house is livable, is safe, right? Is safe and livable, and that matters. The next biggest pot is the biggest pot is actually the federal pot. But you heard me say that we had applications, maybe there were applications for like 200 demolitions through that possible sort of private property assistance. But the expectation is that the number of demolitions that are going to be needed are closer to like 1650. That's a lot of demolitions. That's a lot of demolitions. Right. And while there is $250 million for demolition, only about $20 million will probably be able to be used because of eligibility restrictions from the feds. So this is an interesting thing. Right. Again, here, the need outweighs the resource. But even of the resources there, it's not like just because the money's there, it's accessible. Right? Because the money's here to do a lot of demolition, but we're not eligible for a lot of it, if not most of it. People applied for FEMA dollars, as Michael will tell you, but many of them didn't qualify. Maybe because they had insufficient damage, or they didn't, or there was pre-existing neglect in some way, or what I like to call deferred maintenance, like what many of us do, right? Because if you can't afford the big thing now, you know, you waiting in time. So the presence of money isn't the presence of support. The amount of money that we have isn't enough to meet the need, right? And the people who are in the greatest position to advocate for need, you would think our political establishment, has not yet mastered doing that at the state and federal levels in the ways that are netting the resources, right? That that Ms. Jones and Michael and everybody else can experience in their house yet. That hasn't happened. So that gets me to the, like, we have to, as community members, we have to figure out how do we strategically apply pressure at the levels that matter most to get the support that we need to live.
Sure. And we're going to talk about that. If you've just joined us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are talking with Dr. Michael McLemore and Rebecca Bennett, who've been immersed in this whole, I call it Tornado Louie, since May 16th. And you heard Michael say that he was directly and personally impacted. So here's my question. And this is one of the things I also asserted. We have a chance, based on the level of devastation on the north side, to really reimagine what it could look like in terms of community. What I kept hearing was, we're going to help this family renovate and rebuild, and maybe it's three houses on a block. That is not how you build community. And so I know that means that hard decisions have to be made, but we have two development agents. We got community development, we have St. Louis development. Okay, these folks are supposed to be helping in this particular moment re-envision what it could look like. And I know to your point, Rebecca, and yours too, Michael, that people want to stay where they are, but in some cases, those houses are gone.
That's
So
right.
no matter what they want or desire, that's not even an option. So why are we not talking about how do we rebuild the North Side so that it looks like a viable community as opposed to helping two houses here and then the rest of it looks like hell, or, five blocks over, we're going to help this business. I just don't understand the way that we proceeding when we have now a chance, because here's what happens, and this happened in Katrina swept through there, because the plan was people were so busy trying to just live and survive, the developers swooped in, and now we have a completely different New Orleans. The developers canceled out the public school system and bought in charter. People didn't come back to live. Only certain places in the Ninth Ward were able to be rebuilt. So they had a plan that was not based on the community. And what I'm saying, and maybe it's even to your point, Rebecca, is that if we're going to be advocating, why not advocate for not just the money, but how we want that community to look off, 5, 10 years down the line? So is that even a
Michael, did you want to
conversation in the
lean in
meetings that
before I
you?
say
Yeah,
something?
you both have been in those kinds of meetings where they're talking about like recovery and money. What are we talking about is a viable plan for a community?
So it's weird how all of this kind of like worked together and coalesced into, the tornado and what recovery looks like. But also at the same time, a lot of the impacted neighborhoods were going through the neighborhood planning process where you have community members playing active parts in through Plan STL to kind of re-envision what they want the neighborhoods to look like. So I think just prior to the tornado, you had neighborhood plans completed for I think like the Ville, the Greaterville, some of those areas. And now we're getting to the point like they're not necessarily funded yet, but the plans are there. But now I think we're getting closer to the completion of planning for Zone 4 that includes areas like O'Fallon Park and JVL. And, I think Penrose is a part of that discussion as well. So, while all of the recovery talk is happening, like it's quieter and, kind of, less public, but Plan STL is also holding community town halls and workshops with, members from those neighborhoods that serve on those committees. That are really, playing an active part into, what kind of businesses they want to see in the neighborhood, what kind of like traffic calming measures they want to see, improvements for the schools and alleys, all these kind of different things. So, my biggest thing for especially for people within the impacted zone and thinking about recovery is that, while we attend the tornado town halls and, we get that information and resources, but we also need to lock in on these, neighborhood planning meetings as well. Because you don't want these changes and all these things to happen to you without you, right? You want to take an active part and kind of get your ideas across and join these committees and workshops so that it'll better reflect, what you've seen from the neighborhood, especially if you've been there for decades, similar to like my family has, right? We've been on Lexington since 73. So, we've seen the changes and we have a really good grasp on the, what the needs are in the neighborhood. What'll make, life easier for a lot of folks right now. Currently where my home is, there's a grocery store 1 mile to the east and then 1 mile to the west. There's nothing in between. So when you think about stuff like groceries, it's a food desert. There's no pharmacies at this point. The library is set to open next week. So, we're lacking in a lot of different things right now. But the same way we again like how we lock in for these tornado hearings and those resources, I would just really implore folks to get more involved in these neighborhood planning missions so that they can have a better idea and provide their own ideas as to what their neighborhood will ultimately look like. And then to our previous conversation about like rallying around like our federal delegation and stuff, I did actually go to Washington, D.C. back in December with a group called Organizing Resilience that included 90 disaster survivors from 10 different states to really advocate for the FEMA Reform Act that would ultimately pull FEMA from under DHS so that it would streamline services to make getting access to resources that much easier. while also taking politics and, all these different things out of the discussion. So that way the road to recovery is much easier. So I just say that to say that, we're also still applying pressure up on the federal level as well, because they need to hear us too. We know that, Senator Schmidt or Holly really don't have any teeth in the game in on North St. Louis, right? But they're elected officials, and unfortunately, they're the ones that have to represent us. So, we're definitely full court pressing on them as well to, take a more active approach. And even the congressman, we need more activity out of Wesley Bell. So, stuff like
Absolutely.
that. So,
And Michael, you're making me think about when you talk about the individual neighborhoods that have been planning. And Rebecca, I know part of your toolkit is helping to mediate and coordinate conflicting interests sometimes with different parties. And I can't help but think that some of these communities, neighborhoods are going to be pitted against each other. And sometimes the folks who are most organized and most vocal, of course, get the oil to the squeaky wheel. How do you think they should be approaching like the varied interests and desires of these communities so that at the end, we're not still debating and fighting 10 years later about who gets what?
And you're asking me a big question, Mama Jamala. I wish I had an easy answer in my back pocket. I'm gonna backtrack just a little bit and just say that $110 million that we're talking about for Rams, all of that would not actually go to home repair. So about 30 million of that would go for towards neighborhood planning that you heard Michael talk about, right? And so there's some debate about that, about like whether or not all of it should go to home repair and then some other money come for neighborhood planning, or should you divide the pot because we know the need is great, right? So I do want to say that part of the intention within that funding stream is to be able to put some real dollars behind the existing neighborhood plans that Michael talked about in like Plan Area 1, Plan Area 4, Plan Area 5. When he talked about four, your O'Fallon, Primrose, Fairground, College Hill, Hamilton Heights kind of community. One is your Greaterville, your Kingsway East. Five is like your Academy, your Fountain Park, Lewis Place kind of areas, right? So we get a sense. I think one, I want to say I believe in resident-led development and community engagement. It's not easy. It's not easy because we are mitigating at times competing visions, competing priorities, right? But we have deep attachment to where we are. And we want things to be better, not just for us today, but for the future. You heard Michael say his people been there since 1973, right? That's 50, let me try to do the math, 53 years,
3 years.
right? 53 years. That's about as
Probably
old as I am.
older than Michael.
Bobby,
Right?
yeah, how
Right?
far?
And so there are things that we have in common, and what we have in common, even if our priorities and our processes might be different, is we typically want to see things get better over time. We want people to be able to live where they are and not be displaced. We want to be able to access services, the likes of which you heard Michael talk about, groceries and other things. There's a lot that we hold in common. And so part of what I think could happen, should happen, needs to happen is we need some basic levels of funding commitments for our neighborhood plans that are fairly standard, right? So we need to make sure that if the plans exist, there are resources for them. And we need to do that beyond our city dollars. So this is a perfect opportunity. Remember, you heard me talk about, right, what are our different pots of money? There's federal money, right? There's state and city money, and then there's philanthropic money and private money. Hello, right? Who stands to benefit from recovering neighborhoods? It's not just our governments with stronger tax bases, right? The better our houses are, the more supports and resources we have, the more we buy, the more we invest, the more we, right? So if you've got a basic level of funding and support for implementation of neighborhood plans from our government dollars and support. Why not leverage philanthropic support around resident-led development, right, and planning? And why not leverage private sector support? Now, it gets a little interesting because you heard Michael say we're not trying to lean into predatory practice, right? And so assessing motivation. But there's a place, private capital is significant. And private capital often has investment in development. So what kind of no interest, low interest products, right, become possible as a way of investing in community?
So
So I'm
Rebecca,
starting.
I'm gonna stop you there because I want you to also incorporate into what you're responding to in the fact that some of those areas have what I call pre-existing conditions in
Oh,
terms of disparity, the housing stock, all of that. And so
absolutely.
what I'm hearing people say out loud, some of those neighborhoods aren't worth saving just because of the devastation that existed before and what the tornado did. And so I'm thinking the lens of a developer might be the same. Like, I'm gonna do this neighborhood over here because they got some stuff going, you know, there's some housing stock that's worth salvaging, but this, I'm not going to put any money over there because it's going to take too much. So as you're trying to grapple with that, talk about what that could look like. That's why I'm concerned about we're going to get pitted and some people are going to be left out in the cold, and then there's going to be swaths of land over there on the north side where there's nothing, including people's hopes and dreams.
Especially if we end up getting more demolitions to happen than we get dollars in repair,
Exactly,
then we are
exactly.
definitely going to see large swaths. I think this is when we need to get real creative, Mama Jamala. When I think about places like Joplin and others, they were worried that they'd lose population, but in their tornado impacted areas, they were able to actually 5 years later, they saw that they had a net increase in population by 20%. They started co-locating higher education resources, healthcare resources and centers, right? Financial supports and services. So what they did, right, by placing all of those desirable uses that everybody needs, by the way, but that if you poor and if you black and if you other things, you're not going to be able to accessibly get. You're going to have to drive to go get them. By locating them in communities that their communities that were most impacted, right, they became stabilizing presences and anchors for maintaining population and attracting, right? And that investment then netted other investment, right? Other kinds of investment that have come since. And so, yes, the communities that we're talking about have been historically disinvested from because of who lived in those neighborhoods, right? Because we were there. This is an opportunity to not only address an immediate crisis, but to correct a historical wrong, right? Like that's the vision that we need here is much bigger. We're not trying to get back to May 16, 2025. That's not what we're trying to get back to. We're trying to get better than where we were because how we got to May 16, 2025 was by neglecting our communities. And by the way, this is a community that had a high renter population. And I say that because it had some of the most affordable housing in our city. So when we start again thinking about what the devastating impacts are over time in cities that don't have affordable housing, many of our spaces don't, we were already struggling with that. Now our housing stock got even smaller, right? In terms of affordability. And then for the people who live there and own their homes, 75% of them actually own their homes and they didn't have mortgage on them, right? So we start talking about that's wealth right there, and it's multi-generational stability there, right? So I'm looking like we got this great opportunity. We got a great opportunity, Mama Jamala. The last thing I'll say is to get our institutions to co-locate and anchor in communities that they neglected and weren't in before. And the other thing is non-traditional developers. Hello. Now I'm starting to talk about different kinds of like community-based development. So I'm going to stop because I know Michael has some things to say, but I would love, right, not to just look at the usual suspects, but how do we own, How do we own? How do we co-own our developer assets and resources? How do we enter into agreements with each other to develop our own communities? And a number of our neighborhoods have been thinking about what it looks like to take ownership or leadership of the development that happens, and not just in decision making, but also in actual construction, ownership, shared ownership. I think this is an opportunity for us to get out of the conventional ways of thinking about how we develop community.
I totally agree, and it reminds me the People's Hurricane Relief Committee, which was central to recovery in New Orleans, coined the phrase, "Nothing about us without us is for us." And so that just speaks to what you're saying, that we got to have ownership. We have to be respected as thought leaders, as advocates in our own communities. So Michael, why don't you talk about that, and also what's coming up, that people ways that people can support this effort? Because it's really too much. It's not just the victims who need to be doing this work. This is a community problem, and all of us need to find ways to support.
Yeah, I mean, and we look at it especially still as an organizing fight, right? So we organize people from outside the impacted zone. We have people that come from Wentzville on a monthly basis to, our monthly meetings to really kind of speak about what the updates look like and different ways that they can kind of lock in step with us and, work with us through recovery. As far as our kind of next steps that we're really pushing towards right now, we have a rally around Rams Dollars at City Hall on Friday the 15th at 12 o'clock. The anticipation is that Rams legislation will be introduced earlier that day at the full Board of Aldermen meeting. And our rally is kind of in response to the contents of that bill. So we have that on the 15th. And then on the 16th, there is a budget hearing about the city budget being held at the Herbert Hoover Boys and Girls Club. I think that's at 10 a.m. So we have that as well. And they'll kind of speak more into the updates around the full city budget that includes, a lot of the hot button issues, especially around what the police budget looks like. And hopefully we'll get, more answers around what that looks like, especially considering they sued, well, the police board sued the city this week. And then also on the 19th, we saw that the STL Recovers is holding their next town hall at the O'Fallon Park YMCA. I think that's at 5:30 p.m. So our ask really right now is for people to really come out and, rally around us and, support one, the demand for at least 150 million of Rams dollars to go towards the rebuild efforts in North St. Louis. And then two, make your voices heard about the city's budget, especially, the unwarranted increases around the police budget when, I guess they were operating in good faith, gave them more than what they were required to. But now we see that, that was probably not the best direction to take.
Not the best. That was a stupid.
Well,
That was stupid.
I'm glad you said.
I can do that, Michael.
All right.
I might do it in public at that meeting. So yeah.
Hey.
But to your point, I think there all the things that you mentioned are ways that people can come get information, find out the best way that they can support people. But this is going to be a critical time with that budget stuff, because if we don't get the money that's necessary, we're just going to be talking in the wind about what we wish could happen, what we want to happen. The dollars are important.
Absolutely, because the Board of Commissioners want a percentage of everything. That includes the Rams dollars, that includes the city's reserve fund. So you talk about the depletion of city services and departments, it'll also play a major role in further slowing down this tornado recovery process. So it's definitely something that I think folks should really start to really pay attention to.
And I know that Dr. Punch is not here, but I definitely told him I would announce the 314 Oasis Day of Remembrance coming up on Saturday at O'Fallon Park from 9 to actually 4. It says 9 to 11.
It's nine
And
to
then,
11 there because
oh,
we
at
are partnering
O'Fallon.
and then at
Okay,
Fallon
nine.
Park.
Oh yeah, I'm reading it now. Fountain Park won the fourth, so they're gonna hit two parks, park to park. That's what it's called, duh. So 9/11 at O'Fallon, and then they're gonna have a little break, and then come to Fountain Park, where they had for the last year really have been having services there, and information. So really, it's a time to be a part of the healing process that's still going on, but meet people that have been affected by the storm, meet people who are working to support it, and find out where you can fit in. So it's a lot going on, y'all. There's no need for us to be sitting around to my wonder what I can do to help. It's here, it's there, and the money, show us the money. That's going to be a key part of it, because if we don't get that budget, that city budget, the way it's supposed to go for our community, we'll have to wait another year to talk about that. And we don't have that. We don't have the luxury of that. I want to thank my guests today, Dr. McLemore, Rebecca, who's a doctor in her own right. We all got PhDs in something that we didn't get, we didn't have to pay for, but we paid for it in a different way. So thank you all for sharing your expertise. And we really need to get you back on after some months have gone by, particularly the budget process, to see what we got and what we didn't get. And I'm going to keep people involved. If you want to hear more about this, I'm going to have all the leaflets on that Mike talked about up on the website, jamalarogers.com. We'll have this show up on the website by tomorrow. So yeah, so we got stuff going, y'all. It's no sense of just being sitting around and scratching our heads, wondering what's going on and what to do. We have two people that gave you a plethora of stuff. It might have been even overwhelming, but just pick one event, and say, I'm going to that, I'm gonna find out what's going on, and I'm gonna do something. I'm gonna do something. Because this summer, I think it's going to be a pivotal in terms of what's looks like for this city and how we're going to function. And it may not be good unless we do some real massaging and intervention. But our kids are not doing well in many different ways. But I do want to piggyback off of Michael saying that the two libraries that were damaged will be open on May 18th, and that was Julia Davis and Cabney. And we just got the release of the test scores, reading scores from last year. Our kids are 80% under reading level. They're dropping precipitately from previous years. It's the lowest it's been in a many, many years. So get those babies to those libraries. It's going to be cool. It's going to be a fun place for them. So yeah, we got to make sure that our kids are continuing to learn and thrive in the environment that's being created for them, unfortunately. Again, thanking you all for being here. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. And remember, nothing about us, for us, without us. And we got to be at the forefront of this, y'all, or else, these people will do whatever the hell they want to do. And then we won't have time to complain. The money will be spent. And so we know how they do it. Let's be proactive. Thank you for listening.